So I'm here in the Pleasance Dome, and I'm talking to Dave Waller. Dave, what's your real name? Because I've heard Dave Waller's a stage name, so people in Cornwall won't recognise you up here.
Yeah, that's right. My real name is Dave Waller. So I thought I could pick the name that's furthest away from the name Dave Waller to just get that disguise as three-dimensional as I could.
I saw your show, and I really enjoyed it, and it really does deal with... In some ways it's a journey, but there's a troubled Dave Waller in relation to his roots, isn't there?
There is, yeah. Basically, whenever I'm at home in Cornwall, when I stand in someone's semi-constructed extension on the house, I get a massive masculinity deficit issue going on. And unfortunately, I'm at a stage of life now where everyone is building extensions. So, yeah, I feel very un-Cornish. Maybe, essentially, in the fact that I've never owned a shed. And when I did try and demolish my brother's shed, I did it standing on the roof, hammering downwards with a sledgehammer. I was like, all these sort of things are basic things. You should never hammer down. Just be on ground level and go that way. And then I nailed a bit of wood to my shin. So these are all the things. Whenever I've tried to be more Cornish, it just doesn't work for me.
So when you decided to bring a show to Edinburgh, which explored your Cornish roots, your own identity, you know, and how you escaped into hip-hop, but and then tried to bring hip-hop back to Cornwall. You've got an improv background, as you know, well as you've done other kinds of performance. But what made you decide to actually bring something that's fairly scripted?
What happened, actually, I was in the middle of an improv show a while back, and I was in the middle of a scene and it wasn't working. And I had this vague feeling that there was 80 people in the audience out there somewhere, but they were so disconnected to what we were doing. Like, we were all caught up in what we should be doing now to make a scene work. And I remember thinking, this would work best if I could turn 90 degrees to the audience and just talk to them directly. So that's where the origin of the show writing came from. I just wanted to be able to do that, to address people directly. And also, my day job is a journalist, so I write for a living and I make things up on stage. But I was like, what happens if I wrote for the stage and basically made my journalism a live thing?
But also, I mean, this is a story with some milestones along the way, so it benefits from having a bit of a structure to it.
Yeah,
love those kind of answers. So in terms of the show that I saw, I mean, is it bullet pointed? You know, you've got some headlines and you improvise around them, or is it pretty scripted?
It's getting increasingly scripted, but I had to take a long time before I actually wrote anything down, and that came from maybe mainly saying out loud in performances and then realizing what I'd said, and that was, there's been a process of honing it down. So it's like, I almost see it like an album. There's an A side and a B side, and each bit is a track, and it's gradually got more and more concise as I've gone, basically. But yeah, one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the process, when I had the idea for the show, I wrote down, actually, at the time, I don't want it to be something I've just thought of in my bedroom and wrote down. I want it to come from real life experiences, a product of 2 years worth of getting out there and doing stuff. So that's why it has the shape it does.
I also remember it was in a Kurt Vonnegut book that he kind of talked about one way you could see your life is as a great long line of stuff. And as you look behind you, you know, there's the wardrobe I bought when I was 20, and, you know, there's the teddy bear at 6. And then laying up into the future is all the stuff you could have and you will have. Your story is a kind of line of LPs, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And now, actually, I think since you saw the show, I now start the show as a discussion about the first album we ever bought with the audience. We have a chat about it. And so I've actually got my first record on stage, and we're, you know, talking about that. But they started off as rap music, and now I've got records like the one I have in my hand, which is Breath Sounds, which is basically an asthma record. So my story is getting weirder, as is the one with Terry Wogan selling underwear. So, yeah, LPs are a feature, but it's getting increasingly bizarre as I go on.
I'm still proud of my Shut Up Or Your Face, Joe Dolce 45, but the first album I bought was, I think it was Out of the Blue by ELO, actually. Because we're quite interested in theatre, there's something about the legacy of LPs that when you take them out, there's something precious about them, even to people that have probably never even played one.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the idea. That's why I'm collecting all this stuff now, because I think when in 40 years' time, it's going to be even more bizarre than it is at the moment to have records. So the kids who are yet to be born, basically, when I'm 80, I can be that scary old dude who lives down the road who just basically strikes the fear of God into children. And I can do it through a collection of incredibly weird records. Yeah. But what I also like about these, most of the records I have, I use in the show, are secondhand, and I bought them anywhere from Cornish car boot sales to Chicago record stores. And what I really like about the objects is that this very object has been around for 40 or 50 years and just been passed around through various people's houses and collections, and it's found its way to me, which I think is great.
I'm just wondering if it's an LP, but we've just heard the Harry Potter tune going on in the background. I don't know if it's someone's mobile phone going off or piped in music, but music's... you know, really important to people, and your story is also about the music that has defined you.
Absolutely, yeah. So now I think the crux of the show is being defined by music that fundamentally makes no sense to you. So music, I had the thought that if I was growing up listening to, for example, white people wailing about love, I might have a slightly more developed sense of like emotions than I do. As it is, I grew up listening to people from New York talk about having cars and money, and it's like, well, I have neither of those things, but yet I'm quite emotionally stunted. So, you know, that was kind of one of the beginning points. It's like, I love all this music, but what has it given me?
Something I came away from the show wanting to ask you is that you make a point, I don't want to kind of to put spoilers in, but you do point to the fact that, say, in New York, in the Bronx, that people had to create their own kind of cultural ownership, and it took the form of hip-hop, and it came out of very little, and it was all the richer for that, really, because no one could take it away from them. But you also then kind of contrast it with a very, very hundreds of years old tradition of folk music and some of the LPs that, you know, are basically just reproducing what hasn't changed in hundreds of years. Do you think in a couple of hundred years from now, in New York, in the Bronx, or wherever it is, we're going to be kind of sneering at hip-hop in the way that we sort of sneer at folk music?
Probably. I have no answer to that. Who knows? We'll probably all be underwater, so any kind of, any vinyl, actually vinyl may be one of the few formats that survives the imminent floods.
Yeah, but you show us a guy, you know, on film in the US who's making hip-hop music, and he's alive with creative excitement in what you show us. I'm just wondering, were people doing that when they were creating, you know, a sea shanty?
I reckon they were. Actually, I found out through making the show a lot about Cornish folk music that was going on in the 60s, and it was actually a big hub for people hitchhiking down from London to get down to places like St Ives. And there was a folk club, which one of the guys who features in the show on record, they used to run folk nights and have 400 people come down to this barn on the cliffs. And then basically at sunset, they would stop the gig and all go outside and watch the sunset and then come back in and finish the show, which I think is really cool. So I think actually it did used to have that vibrancy. And in some respects, have more of it, because now, as you see in my show, the music being made is all done on computer.
What hip-hop are you finding up at the Fringe?
I've seen Baba Brinkman's show, The Rap Guide to Religion. I'm going to see a Banda Man tonight. And there is a Cornish hip-hop group called Head Love and Pass Man, who I have never seen, but I hear good things about. They're very silly. That's it so far, I think.
And how are you refining and developing the show as the run progresses?
I'm learning which bits, or just learning to play with it all more. So after the first couple of shows, I think I was still kind of getting my head around the words, but now I'm feeling much more comfortable with that. So it's becoming just playing with the people who are there. So really tapping into other people's tastes and then letting that be the seed for the whole show, really. Yeah, and it's fun, having fun with it.
Are there certain advantages and disadvantages about doing it in a pub venue rather than, say, in a black box space under lights on the stage?
I reckon, yeah, I think free fringe, so I made a conscious choice to adapt, make sure I was flexible with it. So I don't know if there's advantages, but each has their advantage, I guess. And the advantage of this one is it's very, very personable and very personal. And like there's now a bar person in my room, but I brought them into the show, so they're now part of the show as well. So you can adapt to these changes and make it feel very natural. Whereas a theatre may make it more of a fourth wall thing a little bit, just because lighting and stuff may mean I can't really see my audience, things like that. But obviously in a theatre space, I reckon I would have better sound quality and better lighting and be able to create something a bit more poignant with it as well, which I maybe lose a bit of that because we're just all here having a moment together.
Final question, any plans to play this show in Cornwall and in the Bronx?
Yes, I've already done a run out in Cornwall in a village full of pensioners in a fishing village. Like I did a really early rough version, which was very factual, not very funny. And they all came away going, that was very interesting. So they had a good time. Also, I met a load of people in New York who were really interested by the idea of what I was up to. So, yeah, I want to go back. Because I think it's great to go back to New York as someone from a village on the other side of the planet and tell them about their culture. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Dave Waller, better known in Cornwall as Dave Waller. Thank you very much indeed.